You're listening to Niagara Voices and Views on CFBU 103.7. This is a show that's focused on contemporary issues and ideas that are defining St. Catharines and the broader community. We're inviting you to not only listen to NVV, but also get involved and help expand and enrich the conversation about issues in the region. Future shows will explore issues about poverty reduction, conversations about the creative city and gentrification, livable wages, education, employment and equity, and how all of these mix together in the place we live in. We're looking for researchers, writers, reporters, producers, and hosts to work with CFBU in an environment that will provide experiential learning, develop skills, and help you find your voice about issues that matter to you. We're always looking for input and opinions. Check us out on Facebook or email us at talk@cfbu.ca. This week's show is taking a look at the notion of cultural and creative cities and the spaces within it. And we're lucky enough this week to have conversations with two different individuals within the city of St. Catharines who make things happen within those spaces. We're talking to Elizabeth Chitty, who is an artist, a cultural worker, and an activist whose current project, Confluence Field Trips, is about the notion of histories and the downtown and how it sort of relates to how we understand St. Catharines. Our second interview today, we'll be talking with Stuart Reed, who is the director and curator of Rodman Hall in St. Catharines, which is presenting a few shows that are opening in the month of October, and we talk a little bit about what Rodman Hall is and the role it has in the community. So, Elizabeth, tell us a little bit about this project and tell us a little bit about how different individuals can get involved with this as well.
Confluence Field Trips is a website, a walking project, which is the part that began yesterday, an exhibition, and a performance. There's a website that I encourage people to visit called confluencefieldtrips.ca. And it has right now close to 20 pages, and it's a site that is never finished in as much as it has an entire section in the menu called Explore. And I intend to update that on a regular basis as I find new information from my continuing research, which I've been doing quite a while now, and from the information that comes to me via community engagement. The participatory aspect of the project is critical. It's a basis of it. And people, both from the Brock community and the public at large, self-organize in groups to go on a Confluence field trip, which is a walk. The project, I'm kind of scattered here in my approach, but I'll back up a bit. The Confluence in the title is the confluence of Dix Creek and 12 Mile Creek. And in my work, I have been working with what I term the North Niagara watershed, although in fact, scientifically, there is no such thing, but I use that term anyway. I've been working with waterways in the North Niagara watershed since 2008, and this work is naturally from that within that body of work, and from two works ago called Streaming 12, which was an installation at Rodman Hall. Anyway, it is it was instigated through the buildings, the new buildings, the Marilyn I. Walker School of Fine and Performing Arts, where the exhibition will take place in January as part of Imagining the City, and the First Ontario Performing Arts Centre, where there will be a short performance as part of Niagara Shebang. And that, in fact, was where this project had its origin in January, February of 2015. So the confluence is the confluence of those two waterways. The buildings are perched above what is called Canal Valley, which I find a fascinating fascinating site. It's rich with these cycles of wilderness and industry and abandonment and neglect and reclamation, and these new buildings represent the current contemporary reclamation of the site. There are three Confluence field trips, three walks. The first one goes from the school to Rodman Hall. The second one is in the makes a loop around Dix Creek in Centennial Gardens. And the third is just on the other side of Westchester. It's an area that is, I've seen, identified both as Princess Park and as the Charles Michener Park. Those all three areas are following essentially the Merritt Trail almost entirely. Not 100% in Confluence field trip number one, because we have to leave the trail to get to the buildings. And these sites, I dearly love them, and I am fascinated and very attracted to them as liminal space. I swore I would never use the word liminal, but here I am, because it is the perfect word. I haven't even counted them, but maybe 100 photographs on the website. And you will see in the imagery, which are just like, you know, iPhoto snaps, I think that they express this in-between nature of the space, because they are still very much, they're very close to a state of neglect. Mm-hmm. And areas of these sites have been, in some ways, belong to subcultures or groups that some language might be disenfranchised. I guess I'm looking for another adjective.
Well, maybe it's also that these are spaces that, when you talk about them, and I agree, some words sort of take on a notion you don't want to use. I try not to use transgressive the same way you were talking
God,
about
I haven't been able to use that word since the 1980s.
It does really speak to a kind of way in which language is a living thing, and sometimes it goes into places you don't want it to go. But when we're talking about liminal spaces, maybe it also means that these are spaces that, in terms of a history of a site, are ignored, and sometimes you see communities happen within them that are also ignored in a larger sort of context.
Put very beautifully, thank you. I just might steal that.
Actually, I was going to say, feel free to do so.
Yes, because these are sites which have, for a long time, been ignored. And the municipality, and in fact some other jurisdictions, have from time to time done something about them, in the sense of there are trails there. Like the trail system here in St. Catharines is, I love it. I absolutely love it. And Merritt Trail is a wonderful thing. And fairly recently, with the annoying bicentennial of the War of 1812, there was some excellent trail work done there with the Laura Secord Trail. And it uses parts of existing trails. And it, for example, is also part of Confluence field trip number two and one. So there, and I'm very interested in infrastructure. I'm fond of thinking about sewers and things, and this is, I came to my inner engineer very, very late in life, entirely as a result of the work that I do with water in my artwork. And in my last work, Lucius Garden, became it was based on the first waterworks. Mm-hmm. And I think that was, well, actually the one before that, Streaming 12, was concerned with, in part, with the hydroelectric power generation on the 12, which is historically the cradle of electricity in Canada. Anyway, I digress. My point is that over the course of the last couple of works, I've developed a very keen interest in infrastructure. And infrastructure around water and other utilities is, of course, a critical aspect of how the civilized world, in quote, lives together in groups. And actually, I shouldn't even say civilized world, because everywhere where people have lived in groups, which is basically everywhere throughout history. There's infrastructure, whether it's a well or whatever, for the very act of being in relationship with one another. In Confluence Field Trip Number 2, there's a this concrete, long concrete pad, and I would walk by it and think, "What the hell? You know, what is that? Okay to say on the radio? What what is that?" And one of the there's a historical site there which has been very clearly claimed by skaters, and I thought maybe it's got something to do with the skaters, and it was a municipal attempt to embrace them. But then on one walk, I discovered this plaque on the ground, and it was a sewer project, an infrastructure project between the province and the municipality quite recently. I think it was 2008. These walks go around, like Dix Creek was used for the first and second well and canals. Now, that's another interesting aspect of the liminality, to use the L word. If you were in Peterborough or Ottawa, you would find that the historic canals are have been for many years heavily embedded in the sort of destination consciousness of the tourism industry, etc. And here in Niagara, there have certainly been significant attempts, including by some politically powerful people, to do the same with the historic well and canals. And nothing has happened yet. And I do hope that it does happen. But in the meantime, I'm myself heavily drawn to these spaces while they are in this in-between space. You have these wonderful, they're very beautiful, historic ruins, really, of historic canals. And they are part of a creek system, of a creek called Dix Creek, that basically, through my research, I have a fabulous contact at the Niagara Peninsula Conservation Authority, who's she's very helpful to me and has been in the past. Dix Creek, essentially, it's got loads of tributaries. It's not like a creek. But that part is the part that many of us know as Dix Creek. It basically runs almost throughout everywhere in St. Catharines. And, for example, where I grew up, the area, it's near the Penn Centre, not quite at our end, but in the other end of Jacobson Avenue is the name of the street, which was like an early subdivision in the 50s. It was famous for very wet basements, and I only recently learned in my research, just because Dix Creek. And I'm fascinated by, and of course it's in any municipality, in anywhere in North America, probably in Europe too, that waterways, natural water systems have been buried for that 50 subdivision, you know, being a great example. I should let you speak.
Well, yes and no. I mean, actually, to be honest, I think this is all excellent background. And I'll be putting up, when I put this show online, as many of my listeners know I like to do when I put it up at my blog at bartgazzola.com, I'll be putting up links to Elizabeth's page for this and a lot of other information. Anything you want to pass on to me, I'd be happy to put up there. And what I was actually just going to add is that when you're talking about these areas. Well, two things I wanted to sort of add. When you were talking about the skaters, one of the things that's interesting is when we see these spaces before they're made into kind of official spaces, it's interesting how communities will simply claim them for themselves. And that kind of comes back to when we were talking about ignored communities and ignored histories, that sometimes there's a real wealth and ability before they become official sort of tourist spaces.
I prefer that state. Like I say, I'm heavily attracted to the condition of this site right now. And everything changes, nothing is permanent, you know, all is impermanence, and it's going to change again, and there are positive outcomes of that. And I'm, of course, thrilled with the new arts buildings, and they, after all, are a product of the municipality embracing the Creative Cities economic development model.
Yes.
And the outcomes of that are desired to be a transformation, well, more in the urban core, but it could very likely affect these spaces. By the way, way, I realized I didn't yet answer your question, how the public can get involved, and we will get back to that. But these spaces are filled with that, they are, as you've so eloquently put it, ignored spaces used by ignored groups. And I am mindful that I do not want to use my artistic practice as a kind of gentrification tool, but however, I know damn well that it absolutely does not have that power and ability. I have no concerns whatsoever that me bringing attention to them in this way would have any impact on that level. But I do hope that it has an impact on many, many, many individuals and groups who participate. Now, these spaces have strong associations. Because I live here, because I'm deeply embedded in this space, and because I'm involved in many communities, I am aware of the use of these spaces. I've mentioned the skaters, which I have no connection with whatsoever, and I'm sure they wouldn't want to have connection with me. You know, I'd just be an old lady. But
I might also say, too, is that sometimes these communities are so self-contained that they don't even worry about how they fit within a larger narrative either.
Yes, I can see that, although I think often the communities are formed from their exclusion.
Yes.
So therefore there is a relationship and there is a concern, even if it's an I don't care sort of concern.
Yeah, absolutely.
The area, Confluence Field Trip number 2, I know the area's associations as being home around homelessness and sex work, doing some outreach to particular groups who I hope will participate, and I have some very promising results so far. And another area where I'm very connected and concerned that there be, it's not a matter of representation really, although I suppose an argument could be made, I'm seeking representation from certain groups. There's an association with the local indigenous population with that site, and there's a page on my website under the Explore section called Traditional Territory. And I won't describe that because people can go to the site. Anyway, that's a community that I know will be involved in the project, which leads me to how do you become involved in the project?
So how exactly can people self-organize and become part of this? Because I know that there's also ways in which they can add to the site as well.
Well, the exhibition and performance, the media files, the exhibition and performance will be created from the media files that are generated in the Walking Project. So it's participatory and community generated in that sense, that one person on the walk wears a GoPro chesty, that's where the video files come from, and the walks, which are conducted in silence, there's a Zoom recorder passed around, and people can, if they want, speak into it, and those are the audio files. How people get involved is there's a page on the website called SCORE, and I chose to use that word, which will be familiar to people within artistic frameworks, but basically it's just a set of instructions, and that is that it's self-organizing, and you form a group. You choose your walk. You choose, if you want to, a lens for the walk, and there probably isn't time for me to elaborate on that, but it's clear on the website. And then you go to the Book a Field Trip page. There is a legal document there in terms of giving me the right to use the files in artwork and liability waiver. And that was from CARFAC, Ontario, free legal advice service, just by the way. And then you contact me through that page. I see if I'm available. I confirm with you, I come and meet you with the equipment and walk with you, unless you prefer that I not, but it's just to be there if anything arises with difficulties with the technology, essentially. And that's how you get involved. So anyone can do this, and as I mentioned earlier, I have been conducting some active outreach.
Mm-hmm.
I'm speaking, for example, to the Historical Society on September 24th to invite their members to participate, because I know that there will be members of the public there with incredible knowledge about the early Welland canals,
for example.
I've done myself a tremendous amount of research on Richard Pierpoint, but I'll leave that because, again, we don't have time. But there's so the historical aspect is there, but I do not intend that it's. I don't want the work to be entirely heritage based. It's based in a notion of time that spans the past and the present, not particularly the future. And as we've already discussed, there are many communities that have active engagement with these sites now, and I'm seeking their engagement.
Mm-hmm.
Start Me Up, I spoke at their AGM. That's an organization, a wonderful organization, dealing with people on the street and close to the street, and they will be doing a walk. I'm thrilled.
So when you sort of talk about how, well, when you were speaking before, it's like it's not going to be a kind of, as you say, a heritage historical site which offers just one voice about what this place is and what the history is and that this means this and this means that. You're more so looking for individuals, as you sort of say on the site, to speak and to engage and to actually sort of help either speak about the history of this site or also help sort of expand or enhance or even add nuance to the history.
Well, they don't have to even talk just about the history, and that gets to the idea of a lens.
Mm.
Like people from the Historical Society, I'm expecting that that's probably what they'll talk about.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
When they're walking by an abandoned lock on Confluence Field Trip Number 3, they are likely to speak about that. I have a walk coming up with a retired commissioner of planning at the region and his colleague who was worked in the 70s building trails, I think at the federal level. So I'm hoping that they will have things to say on their walk that
mm-hmm.
address infrastructure, for example. So people bring whatever they bring, and whatever you bring is okay with me. And you can choose a lens in the lens from the lens section if you want sort of that assistance
mm-hmm.
Or that option. But it's you say into the audio recorder, and you don't have to say anything if you don't want to, just what you want. And I encourage people to be embedded there in real time in their bodies, walking and commenting on their experience in that moment, which is different than giving, say, a talk about the history. But that will happen too. It's all okay.
I like how you're sort of talking about them being there at that moment. It's like they need to be present in this time and in this place in a very real way, and in a way where there's a multiplicity of voices and ideas. And when you say lens, I can't help but sort of start to think in terms of a kind of metaphor that it's also looking at a place through your own eyes and understanding how it works.
Absolutely.
In
the
a bigger
concept
way.
Of embodiment is very much part of my conceptual and visceral aspects of my work.
So that was artist, activist, and educator Elizabeth Chitty talking about her Confluence Field Trips project, which is something that is happening in a couple of different forms, but right now you can still be part of that in terms of participating in a walk, and those are events and experiences that will be mined for an exhibition both at the Walker School of Fine and Performing Arts and later on at Rodman Hall. But you can simply do a web search for Confluence Field Trips and Elizabeth Chitty and find out everything you need to know to be part of that exciting project. That brings us to today's show, where we're lucky enough today to have Stuart Reed with us, who is the director and curator of Rodman Hall. So, welcome, Stuart.
Thanks, Bart. Happy to be here.
So, for people who may not be that familiar with what Rodman Hall is. Tell us a little bit about it. But I think maybe just to set that off on the right foot, I should also say congratulations for the recent award. I believe it's through the Canada Council?
That's correct. It's the York Wilson Endowment Award, which is granted to one Canadian institution each year to help it purchase a work by a living Canadian artist that will significantly enhance its permanent collection. And Rodman Hall was the winner this year, and we were thrilled. The award is going to support the purchase of Settlement, the artist garden by Marianne Barkhouse, which is currently installed in the gardens in front of Rodman Hall.
That's a very lovely piece, and hopefully my listeners have had the opportunity, as I have, and I'm sure you have, to encounter a number of pieces by Barkhouse. And it's actually a very fun kind of piece that blends in with the landscape. And I have to say, when I made my first visit to Rodman Hall when I moved back here to St. Catharines, that was the first piece I saw as I was walking up there, and I was like, oh, it's Marianne. So it was quite wonderful and kind of a nice greeting, because of course I see all these things in terms of how it relates to me.
Yeah, well, you were talking about Elizabeth Chitty's confluence walks, and I did one of those during the City Treaty celebrations of the opening of the Maryland School on the weekend, and the walk ended at Settlement, and I talked a little bit about how it addresses issues of territory and treaty. You know, it uses the animal world imagery as an analogy for alliances that exist between settling people and Aboriginal cultures, and it also looks at territories as that relates to plants and animals, as well as the struggles of people over land rights. So, you know, it's a very resonant piece for Niagara, I think.
Yeah, and it's also a piece, I think, as well, that really sort of speaks to an idea of how art can often be an extremely contemporary thing, the same way that it can often be a very subversive and sometimes a very direct form of history as well. So in terms of what's coming up at Rodman Hall, tell us a little bit about two shows that are coming up that look quite interesting.
Well, we have an exciting fall planned, and on October the 25th, we're opening two exhibitions. Bill Burns' new exhibition called Hans Ulrich Obrich Hierest, which is a survey of his recent body of work, which is about litanies to art world luminaries. You know, he makes pleas to famous curators or museum directors around the world, sometimes in the form of skywriting with a placard that he flew over the Miami Basel Art Fair saying, Glenn Lowry, help me, you know, flying behind a plane. Or he's done these maquettes of some of the world's great museums with signage put on top of the roof that asks for the art world luminary to help or to hear him or to assist him. And the show, you know, he's always been interested in animal imagery as well, like Barkhouse. And the last show that I worked on with Bill about 10 years ago was called Safety Gear for Small Animals, which toured across Canada. Maybe you saw that in Saskatchewan.
Actually, I did. It was part of, I either saw the show or it was part of a larger show, but I actually was working at the Mendel at that time and was doing a kind of internship assistantship to Bill and to Sheila Urbanowski.
Oh, really? Great.
So I always think of that work when he's mentioned, and that kind of tongue-in-cheek, I don't know how to describe it. I mean, there's an element of sort of bland seriousness to it, as though he's playing poker with you. But at the same time, there's also this kind of directness and irony that's really quite wonderful.
Well, there's a whole meta-narrative that goes along with the work, right? And the new show builds on the narrative of the artist, you know, working his way in the art world and his engagement with that fictitious corporation called Safety Gear for Small Animals, which made little safety gloves and visors and life jackets for squirrels or small furry things that needed rescuing from distressed habitats. And the new work kind of looks at his forays into the art world and his interchanges with curators and museum people, but also thinking about that from an animal world perspective. So again, he continues with the exquisite little watercolors he does, these beautiful renderings with a little bit of text underneath. There's a whole group of those, I think over 30 in our show. And also the miniature, and he's really been engaged with that small world practice. So Safety Gear was all about these beautiful little things in vitrines that people could engage with. And the museum models in this show are much the same as that. He's also constructed a machine which tests the durability of work gloves that are embroidered with Art World celebrities' names on them. There's also a pile of logs in the show, the logs that have been carved with those names on them, and then the logs are washed in a solution of milk and honey,
of course,
alluding to the paradise.
that's actually one of the things that I have to say with this show that I'm very much looking forward to, because there is humor in his work, but there's often a kind of edged humor. And I know in terms of I did not make it down to Regina to see this show when it was in an earlier incarnation at the Dunlop, I believe. But one of the things that is sort of entertaining is the idea of beseeching or sort of pleading for shows, or the idea of sort of asking for favor, as you say, like the notion of the land of milk and honey, and that if you just do these things, then the promise will be fulfilled. And I've often made the joke about how there are times that the art world does seem a little bit like a religion. And I do know that I've kind of made the joke here and there that with the bobbleheads that will be part of this show, that you could in fact maybe sort of have one that you set up a home altar to and sort of pray and hope for Art World success. And and I would just sort of say now that maybe there's one of the editor of Canadian Art that I could use for myself. So it could be something along those lines where it actually has a kind of tongue-in-cheek notion to it. But also I can't help but feel that there's also a little element of anger in there as well, as there is with a lot of humor.
Well, I think that that's true. I think that the art world has become, you know, this cult around these major international fairs and biennials, and that's sort of the pinnacle that artists aspire to. And there's a handful of people that control who is included in those shows. And, you know, I think he's poking fun at the sort of art ecology that's developed around those international art fairs, and that echelon of celebrity that comes to those people that end up on that plateau. And a lot of there's exclusion at work, you know, people you know, you just happen to be overlooked once, twice, thrice, and then, you know, your shot's over.
It is kind of an interesting thing, because I guess I'll look at it from sort of two different ways. One being that there is that kind of art world inertia that happens even at that level that, you know, you sort of see, that's really just a kind of mirror of how you see that at a local level as well. That it's been commented to me that even a major urban center like London is really just made up of smaller centers that sort of reference each other. But it is kind of a fascinating thing, especially when you consider that Bill is quite successful and quite well known. So his sort of commentary on this kind of, again, has a bit more of an edge to it in that respect. There's also kind of an element of humor, or maybe just an element, and I mean this in a very good way, because this is what I quite like with work, an element of kind of oddness in the other show that's opening as well.
Donna Zocchi's exhibition called Cloud, and Donna, of course, is one of the faculty members at Brock and the Marilyn I. Walker School of Fine and Performing Arts. So Cloud is an assemblage of print works and objects that address the notion of relational meaning. So she, like Bill Burns, is using text, and some of her print works, you know, use sort of epithetic little phrases or almost one-liner jokes that are manifest in a particular font or a style that adds another layer of meaning to what the words actually mean. And also the prints are sometimes printed on materials or on paper or with certain inks that have a meaning as well, that's interlaced with the text and with the way the object is manifest. And I think people are going to be really intrigued with some of the things that she's made. I think it's really fascinating work. So it'll be a nice foil for Bill Burns, because I think there's a hand rendering that sort of speaks to his material interests. but they're quiet and kind of worlds unto themselves, each of the little prints and objects that are in the show. One of the flagship images is of a plate of donuts, which looks like the ubiquitous Tim Hortons, you know, icing-laced, sprinkle-laden, you know, beautiful UFO on a plate in fuchsia pink. But they're actually 3D printed objects. So the piece is called Decoy. So they're, although they look like luscious donuts, and there'll be a plate of them in the show alongside real ones, they're fakes. And so, you know, there's a lot of questioning in Donna Zocchi's work as well, which aligns beautifully with the questioning you're talking about that manifests in Bill Burns' exhibition as well.
It's also kind of a funny thing as well when you think about the notion of the history of art and the history of art making, in terms of how often we sort of confuse the object, or how often we confuse the simulacra, the depiction, with the real thing. And just in terms of thinking of something as simple as the history of painting and those moments when people sort of realize that it's not picture box space, it's just paste on a piece of canvas, or it's just like globs of color on a piece of canvas. So sometimes it's fun to sort of play with that in that notion. And yeah, I think also with something like donuts, if you're talking about the kind of symbolic notion of images or the symbolic notion of objects, that's something that's kind of funny, considering how it sort of steps outside of the art world debate into a very sort of populist notion, because donuts being such a sort of universal Canadian thing. And Donna's work will also be on display downtown.
That's right. We have, apart from Cloud, we're opening a show called Satellite at the Visual Arts Gallery at the new Marilyn I. Walker School of Fine and Performing Arts. And that opens on October the 23rd at 7. And that exhibition is an assemblage of digital art practice surveying Donna's engagement with media artworks over the last number of years. There's a new piece called Parlamonium that I'm very excited about, that I think people will be very intrigued with, which has an amazing kind of mesmerizing spiritual quality. We're also going to be showing on an iPad in the show Donna's app, which addresses the buried radioactive mice that are in Niagara Falls, and that's a very intriguing piece too that people will be able to see. And there's going to be a single channel display of a number of videos that she's done over the years too. So it's a bit more of a survey of digital art practice that I think will be a nice foil for the object-oriented pieces and prints at the main show called Cloud.
And when will this show open at the... And I'm assuming this is going to be in the space in the Walker?
That's right. So October the 23rd, that's a Friday evening at 7. It'll open, Satellite will open at the Walker School, and then Cloud will open concurrently with Bill Burns on Sunday, October the 25th at 3 o'clock. And there's going to be a performance and an artist talk with Bill Burns beginning around 2, so people should come a little early on the Sunday.
So in terms of the shows that you have coming up, it's kind of an interesting balance in terms of somebody who's sort of national and international like Bill, and then having a very strong kind of regional or local component with Donna. And there's something else that's coming up that's sort of interesting in terms of an artist who I know I saw their work in Saskatchewan, and someone that's getting quite a bit of play around the country as well.
Camille Turner. Broadman Hall, of course, is very engaged with the Brock community, and we often host symposia, conferences, that sort of thing. So the Center for Social Justice at Brock is mounting a symposium called Consuming Intimacies, Body, Labor, Care, and Social Justice. And that runs at Brock and at Broadman Hall from October 15th to 16th. And there'll be an opening conference opening event on the 15th at Broadman Hall. And in conjunction with the symposium, Camille Turner's working on an exhibit that is a collaboration by Manir Ruzeman and Heather Dewey Hagborg, in consultation with Jim Ruxton. And the piece is called Spare Parts, and it looks at the exchange between a someone selling their body organs and the buyer. Mm-hmm. And so it sets up this exchange with a video installation that'll happen in the Flex space at Rodman Hall. Spare Parts features, two rear projection screens and an image of the seller, as I mentioned, and the buyer, and then a table between them with evidence of the exchange of selling of body parts in between the two figures. I think it's going to be a really interesting show, just up for a short while between October 6th and 18th in the Flex space. So as we're preparing to open our main space shows on the 25th, we had this opening, and we're able to fit this interesting project by Camille Turner into the roster. But the issues, of course, about social justice and bodies and organ exchange, it's an interesting thing, a huge issue in the third world, and I think it kind of echoes with the thematic that we were wandered into with Surinder Dhaliwal's exhibit earlier in the summer. So a really interesting kind of bookend and thematic echo that will also bring a lot of people engaged with the academic conference to a wonderful contemporary art experience too.
Yeah, I've seen pieces by Turner that often play upon notions of class, notions of colonialism, things that sort of are, well, it's always interesting. I'll go back to something that Elizabeth and I talked about in the idea of ignored spaces and ignored communities. But one of the things to also sort of consider in that, and she's talking about that, Elizabeth is talking about that in terms of specific sites and histories, but it also means that there's a dominant narrative that's being given the sort of main grift. And that's something with Turner's work that's always been kind of interesting in terms of speaking about how there is this element of power in terms of how these things are spoken of, and of course also an element of disempowering other groups. And it's rather funny in kind of a weird and strange way how often we've sort of seen this idea of how, well, I was thinking about this last night, the idea that we still sort of see individuals talking about how economic freedoms lead to actual liberty. And of course, we've started to see that that's simply not true. But I can't help but feel this notion of selling organs, or the sort of notions around that it's just another commodity being taken out of a space that has no choice except to sell commodities. And that's something that kind of shows up in Dhaliwal's work as well. Yes. The notion of the empire and the loot from it. But also that idea that if anything, you know, excessive economic freedom leads to the opposite in terms of how you don't, well, you have liberty for a very few. And it's something that is kind of a topical notion in terms of the election that's going on right now about, you know, who actually has freedom and who doesn't, and what you do when you don't have that. So it's a really interesting sort of spate of shows in terms of relevance outside the gallery coming up at Rodman Hall.
Yeah, the other exciting thing about Camille Turner, I appreciate so much what you've just said. I'm my colleague Marcy Bronson, our curator, and I often are thrilled when artists really respond to the ornate parlors of Rodman Hall. You know, it is a site. You know, this gorgeous building was built with money by the Merritt family, who built the Welland Canal and really changed the landscape and opened up Western Canada to development. You know, and there's an ornateness in the parlors that, you know, appropriation of Eastern decorative things, decorative pattern and ornamentation, and the opulence of the Italianate fireplaces and the marquetry in the floor. And placing a work like Spare Parts in those rooms gives it a whole other kind of significance and resonance with the space. And that's something that's very exciting. We often do in our programming at Rodman Hall, where artists have recognized the milieu that they're in and set it off with work that really speaks to that notion of colonialism and imperial power as well, manifest in that house.
Well, that's something that I actually really, really like about Rodman Space, and that just in the few shows I've seen there, that it sort of forces you to acknowledge that gallery spaces are not neutral spaces, that kind of white cube or that whole kind of modernist block notion, and I have nothing against that. It's just that those are spaces that seem to deny any kind of baggage they bring with them or any kind of power they bring with them. And this actually connects back to Bill Burns, where, let's not pretend that these spaces are not political or not politicized or not controlled or, you know, I always like to sort of point out that a lot of times cultural spaces are just as active in manufacturing alibis for those in power as non-cultural spaces. So one of the things I like with Rodman Hall, and this is something with Dalwall show that was just amazing, is that it seemed like it was a perfect space for that, mm-hmm. because it can't pretend that it's just a sort of universal gallery space, so you can't pretend that it's speaking an absolute truth.
That's right.
You understand that the voice that's there is conflicting with the voice of the United Empire Loyalists.
Yeah.
So it's kind of wonderful in that space.
No, I agree, and that is a really unique feature of Rodman Hall, is that we do have the white box at the back, which serves us well, but those parlor galleries are really interesting spaces to program, and I think add a whole dimension to the discourse around the work that's placed in them.
And I think that's one of those things that where uniqueness is more and more of a kind of relevant thing in these spaces, and sort of having something that does have a unique voice that interacts and that the viewer can sort of bring their own ideas to.
I think so, definitely. And, you know, the historical nature of our house is something that in the years ahead, I think it's going to be more of a focus for us to animate. And we're already thinking about ways of, engaging contemporary artists to help tell the story of Niagara and the Merritts and the Welland Canal and Shipman's Corners. And, Elizabeth Chitty's doing that so beautifully in those confluence walks. And, I think that there's a lot more we could be doing at Rodman Hall to animate that house and make it much more of an asset in terms of draw for visitors as well.
And I think that is an excellent place to end, although I do want to just point out that I really liked when you started to refer to it as our house.
Yes.
I quite like that, because it's that whole idea that it is part of the history of this place and part
it is
of this place. Stuart Reed, director, curator of Rodman Hall, thank you for making time to come on the show.
Great pleasure, Bart. Thank you.
So you've been listening to Niagara Voices and Views on CFBU 103.7, truly diverse radio, coming to you from Brock University. This week's show, we talked to a couple of different individuals who gave us a sort of interesting insight into the notion of the creative city, which is a space that St. Catharines seems to be moving towards with the opening of the Marilyn Walker School, but also with a few of the things that both Elizabeth Chitty and Stuart Reed talked about today on Niagara Voices and Views. Just to let you know about what some of the future shows will be holding, we'll be talking with individuals in terms of issues such as poverty reduction, conversations about gentrification and livable wages, but it's looking like right now next week's show will be focused upon notions of poverty, which is something that's been debated quite a bit in the city of St. Catharines over the last few months. So that's something that will be happening on next week's episode of Niagara Voices and Views. You've been listening to CFBU 103.7 FM, truly diverse radio. Keep in mind, you can always follow us on Facebook, and we're still looking for researchers, writers, reporters, producers, and hosts to work with CFBU in an environment that will provide experiential learning, develop skills, and help you to find your voice about issues that matter to you. Here on Niagara Voices and Views, we'd very much like to have your voice and your view, and you can always contact us at talk@cfbu.ca.
Broadcasting from Brock University in St. Catharines, this is 103.7 FM CFBU.